conservatorship of Carolyn New. Good morning, Council.
Morning.
You will each be given 15 minutes for argument this morning. Appellants, you will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Please, before you begin your argument, identify yourself and your client for the audio record. With that, are you prepared to begin? Appellant's counsel, Mr. Carlson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Great.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Carlson. I represent Carolyn Nye, the appellant in this matter. We are asking the court to reverse the district court's appointment of a conservator on behalf of Carolyn. In the alternative, we're asking the court to reverse the appointment of a professional conservator and remand with instructions to appoint Carolyn's choice, her youngest son, Paul. Carolyn seeks to regain her rights, dignity, and autonomy over property affairs in this appeal. Carolyn seeks reversal of the appointment of the conservator for two specific reasons. One, the district court's specific non-statutory findings of fact here are insufficient as a matter of law for the appointment of a conservator under section 524.5409. Second, the district court made clearly erroneous findings regarding Carolyn's son, Paul, regarding potential gifts and a raise for taking care of her. Now, conservatorships are purely statutory. And the legislature has recently modernized over the last 10 years the conservatorship and guardianship statutes with the intent to make conservatorships as well as guardianships rare. And that's through the use of less restrictive means. Now, one of the most recent amendments to the conservatorship statutes and guardianship statutes is the use of supported decision-making as a less restrictive means for conservatorships. And that means that a person like Carolyn can choose an individual to help her make those decisions and help her communicate her decisions regarding her financial affairs. Here, the district court didn't make any specific findings regarding supported decision-making, but did make findings that Carolyn was subject to manipulation based on years-old scams that are stale and regarding years-old late payments on her bills, as well as her credit score dropping. Now, at the time that the district court held the trial in this matter, Carolyn was using her son, Paul, in supported decision-making. Her credit score was around 800. Her bills were getting paid, and there was no worries regarding her ability to pay her bills. So the district court's use of Carolyn's past history, you know, years old history of being unable to pay her bills and her credit score, just are insufficient as a matter of law. There weren't evidence that was relevant at the time of trial, which should be relevant for the appointment of a conservator. The district court also relied on, I don't know what the district court relied on, but made findings that Paul, Carolyn's son, and her chosen conservator, if one were to be appointed, had made gifts to himself or was planning to do in over $30,000. Now, the record evidence and the testimony at trial had nothing to do with Paul making a gift to himself. The record is clear that Paul had told his brother Alan that he was going to possibly claim, on advice of his professional accountant, the money he was earning for taking care of Carolyn and her husband at the time before he passed, as a gift on his taxes. Now, the district court's order here, and the reason why less restrictive means apparently were not available, were concerns about Paul, dissipating her estate. But there's no evidence in the record that Paul's ever done that. In fact, Stephen Nye, one of the respondents, testified that he had no evidence that Paul had ever stolen or swindled from his mother. That's transcript page 131. So the district court's concerns on the less restrictive means portion, specific statutory findings of fact regarding Paul not being able to be that supportive decision-making person of Carolyn's choosing, are clearly erroneous. And if removing those facts from the less restrictive means section, all that is left is the manipulation, those stale old findings. Now, Paul, there was another concern that Paul planned on giving himself a raise. The court was concerned with that, the district court. And that, again, was a clearly erroneous finding. Paul, in conjunction with Carolyn's counsel, decided that Paul, who previously agreed to take care of his mother and father, over 4 days a week at the rate of $760 a week, deserved a raise, because now, after Carolyn's husband's death, he was taking care of his mother 24/7 in his own home. Carolyn moved in with Paul. Now, Paul, in conjunction with Carolyn's attorney, and obviously with Carolyn, agreed to increase Paul's rate each week to around $1,250. Now, considering the time increase, that's why that was done, the amount of care, the amount of time. But the district court apparently thought that Paul did that unilaterally without consent of Carolyn. And again, that would be clearly erroneous. Paul was not planning on giving himself a raise without Carolyn's knowledge or knowing that she lacked capacity. Paul directly worked with Carolyn's counsel, like he should have. So because less restrictive means are available here, the supported decision-making, and the fact that Carolyn had no issue paying her bills at the time of the hearing, had no financial issues at all, actually, this court should reverse just based on that finding. And importantly, respondents at trial could not point to any concerns that Carolyn actually had financial with Paul being a supportive decision maker. And over seven times respondents testified that they were just seeking oversight. They just wanted oversight. Well, that's insufficient as a matter of law to bring a petition for conservatorship, because you want oversight over your mother's estate. Carolyn, Minnesota citizen, has the right to take care of her financial affairs generally as she wishes, regardless of what her children think. Moving on to 524.5409 sub B1A, the record evidence and the specific non-statutory facts cited by the district court do not support a finding that Carolyn suffered from an impairment that rendered her unable to make financial decisions regarding her property. Now, respondents didn't ask Carolyn to testify. No medical person testified. All we have is medical records and a Dr. Molling's report saying that she suffered from dementia. Now, I'm not a doctor. Neither was anyone that testified. But just because someone has been diagnosed with dementia or any other mental health diagnosis doesn't mean that renders them unable to evaluate and receive and make decisions regarding their financial affairs. The record evidence is just insufficient. The district court doesn't cite any medical evidence, but rather relies on those years-old scams and Carolyn's credit score and late bill payments from years ago.
Can I just ask about that? It seems like, I believe the order talked about the diagnosis with dementia, et cetera. I think your argument is that you can only look at a section of the order that deals with and not any of the factual findings that precede that particular section of the order. But aren't all the factual findings at play in determining whether they support a conclusion of law?
I think generally that's correct, Your Honor. But I think here, and I think appropriately, the district court made it very easy for Carolyn and this court to determine why the district court rendered his decision on these specific statutory findings. Now the court, even if the court looks outside those specific statutory findings, again, the record evidence still, there's nothing in the record that shows that Carolyn's impairment or the dementia makes her unable to make those decisions. I think that, generally—
Counsel, doesn't the record show that she's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease?
But Alzheimer's disease, that's probably correct, Your Honor. Alzheimer's disease and dementia are pretty much the same thing.
Well, I guess my question is there any evidence in the record that her Alzheimer's disease has not progressed since her initial diagnosis in 2020?
Well, I think that brings up a good point, Your Honor. One, that diagnosis was old. And I've been involved in cases where there are misdiagnoses. That's why I think it's important to have a fresh diagnosis. And second, it's not Carolyn, it wasn't Carolyn's burden at the trial to prove what her diagnosis was or what she was allowed or, able to do. It was on respondents to bring forth that evidence to show that she suffers from a diagnosis that renders her judgment incapable of making financial decisions. And we can assume that possibly dementia could render such person as a matter of law, but I think that would be too far. I think it's a very fact-intensive inquiry. Everyone who's diagnosed with something has different levels of impairment. And here we don't know exactly what that means.
Well, I think that the report included, according to the court's order, cognitive linguistic deficits in attention, memory, problem solving, orientation, oral expression, speech comprehension, reading comprehension. Those all seem, that's not just purely a diagnosis, that's describing deficits in those abilities, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The question is how do those deficits, how bad are they? And again, it would be very easy. It would have been easy for respondents to just get a doctor's affidavit or someone to testify that those deficits mean that she's unable to take care of her financial affairs because she can't make decisions or evaluate those decisions. And moving to the second prong that's required, that Carolyn's state will be wasted or dissipated. And importantly, the statutory text says that the court must find that her estate would be or will be wasted or dissipated absent management. Now here, the district court in its specific non-statutory findings relies solely on the scams that are years old. But that the years old scams do not mean that Carolyn's estate will be dissipated absent appointment of a conservator. And the record shows that Carolyn's ability to take care of her finances at the time of the hearing were just fine. So the district court's findings under the statutory requirement that her estate would be wasted or dissipated is just insufficient as a matter of law. There should have been more findings there. In a lot of conservatorship cases, someone needs a conservatorship. At the time, their bills aren't being paid. There's some reason why you bring the petition. Here, this petition was brought 2 days after Carolyn's husband died, and the record evidence shows that Carolyn historically has not gotten along well with her son, Stephen, and her daughter, Julie, who are the respondents here. And they brought this petition because they were concerned about oversight, because dad dies. And of course, if you look through the testimony, Stephen had a very close relationship with dad, but not with mom. I mean, Stephen testified that prior to his dad's death, my client, Carolyn, accused him of stealing because he was obviously helping with her and her husband's financial affairs at that time. And that is transcript page 38. So if you look at all the facts here, the facts in the record, and you take away the clearly erroneous findings regarding Paul, unless restricted means portion and the rest of it, they're just insufficient as a matter of law to appoint a conservator. If there's no further questions, I'm going to move to our alternative argument that the court should reverse and remand for the appointment of Paul. Minnesota statute 424.5413 governs the appointment of who can be a conservator and how the court should appoint the conservator. And the statute says that the court shall consider persons pursuant to this priority list. And that, as a matter of policy, was created in 2003. And that was after, the conservatorships and guardianships have been around for a long time, probably since statehood. They decided that full discretion to the court, we cite to a 1935 statute that gave the courts complete, discretion of who to appoint, any person who is suitable and competent. Now courts must appoint pursuant to this priority list. And the district court here, we can infer that because of the clearly erroneous findings regarding Paul, likely did not want to consider Paul. Now, taking away those findings, Paul should have been appointed. He's more than qualified. He's been his mother.
Counsel, isn't there case law from our court that, strife between family members can be a reason for deviating from the list or from the priority list? And isn't that really a credibility finding, something that we should defer to the district court on?
Your Honor, I don't have the case in front of me, but that the case that the Minnesota Supreme Court talked about when families are in two hostile camps, the district court might have to make a tough decision and appoint a neutral, was from about 70 years ago. And that was, again, under that 1935 statute, giving complete discretion to the court. Now, when this, usually this court, when the legislature modifies or amends or creates a new statute regarding a topic, will then, disregard previous case law interpreting the previous statute and interpret the statute that it now governs. And I think here, the legislature, as a matter of policy, decided that it's best to have people that are related to or were entrusted with the rights of a person that needs a good conservator. That's why, a spouse, your own spouse, doesn't have priority over someone that was previously a power of attorney.
Yeah, I understand the Supreme Court cases, but our court has a few published decisions where we have one from 1986 and one from 2007, where, a disagreement among the siblings was also considered. So I do think that there are some newer case law that there's some newer case law that would say there are reasons for avoiding family strife that a district court might consider in making that determination. Is your argument that under no circumstances would the district court have the ability to make those kind of credibility findings?
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. I'll try to make this quick. The 2007 case you're referring to, and I don't remember the name, you're right, it does a published case, and it does speak to appointing a professional in situations like where there's a family feud. Importantly, though, that case relies on the 1986 case, which the 1986 case relies on the case that's 70 years old from the Minnesota Supreme Court. So it doesn't interpret the statute regarding the priority list. And importantly, the statute here says the court shall consider. And then if you read the statute, the whole statute, it actually says that when persons are of equal priority, then the court should choose who's best qualified. And I want to, one last thing, the district court here did not address the family feud argument below. And I think that's important. And I don't think this court should address it either, because there's findings in the record where respondents admitted that they pretty much manufactured this family feud. So really, I think it's just not relevant. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Good morning.
My name is David Johnston. I represent Steve Nye and Julie Richardson, who are two of the respondent, Carolyn, or the appellant, Carolyn Nye's children, in this matter. And this matter was it was thoroughly litigated. It was a two-day evidentiary hearing trial where lots of evidence was presented regarding the medical condition of Ms. Nye, the dynamics of the family, some of the financial financial scams and the problems that Ms. Nye was having with her finances and her health. And so it was thorough. And I thought
when you're referring to that evidence regarding health and medical information, was there something more than the doctor's reports that were submitted? Was there
just evidence we had testimony from the children. So not the only medical evidence that was submitted was the physician's report and medical records from Dr. Molling. And it should be noted that the Dr. Molly and the physician's report did support a guardianship and a conservatorship. The guardianship was not issued, the conservatorship was. So, and that's a doctor that had been caring for Ms. Nye up until the time of the hearing. So that's the medical.
What are the most recent medical records that you submitted into the record?
Gosh, I would have to look back at the record, Your Honor. There was testing done in 2021, I believe, that was submitted. So it was fairly recent. And again, there was no medical evidence submitted by the other side that things have improved or anything like that. So the most current medical records, my client, was a healthcare attorney, and
Did you submit any evidence that it's deteriorated, that her condition has deteriorated?
Not since.
So I do think that appellant is correct that it's your clients who bore the burden. So, is there evidence in the record that her condition had deteriorated from the time of the most recent report?
There's no evidence that it's deteriorated, but I think that the evidence that was submitted was recent enough and showed that, you know, sufficient deterioration to that point to support the, you know, the finding of a conservatorship and the order for a conservatorship. So again, that there was no evidence presented by the other side that things have improved. In fact, Ms. Nye did not testify. And there was, you know, really nothing else for the court to rely on except this medical evidence. The respondents seemed to rely a lot in their brief on the visitor's report, which was very neutral, and, you know, the result of probably a 10-minute interaction between Ms. Nye and the visitor. So, you know, the findings and the order written by Judge Welty was thorough and well thought out, and it did hit on all of the required elements of the statute. 524.5-409(1A) is the statute that's relevant here in finding the conservatorship. And as opposing counsel pointed out, that the statute requires that by clear and convincing evidence, individuals unable to manage property and business affairs. They've been scammed twice. You know, that they had lost $25,000, and you know, I don't fully understand the argument that this wasn't, you know, recent enough. I think, you know, it stopped because Steve, my client, you know, he was the original power of attorney, as was found in the order. He set up auto pay. He took over the finances. You know, he's the reason that the credit score improved from, you know, somewhere in the 600s to somewhere near 800 at the time of trial. You know, it certainly wasn't anything that Ms. Nye had done to improve that. So, I mean, clearly that prong of the statute, the evidence was submitted to meet that. You know, we had the scams, the credit score, the, you know, late checks. There was evidence of delinquent payments, things like that, that were all found by the judge. The second prong is that the individual has property that will be wasted or dissipated unless management is provided or money is needed for support care. Now, again, I think those same bits of evidence that we submitted regarding prong number one also apply to prong number two. You know,
I guess counsel isn't, I think appellant's argument is that the problems with fraud have been resolved by less restrictive means, which you can see by the improvement in Ms. Nye's credit score. And so if there's been a, you know, if you take what appellant is saying, that there's been sort of a resolution, then what evidence is there in the record that her assets could be further dissipated?
Well, there was evidence that the manipulation by Paul, I think that's what the judge relied on. The judge was concerned that, you know, the person providing the less restrictive means was Paul, who the judge was very concerned about his manipulation in the past. I mean, he took, this whole thing started when he took Ms. Nye to his attorney together and changed the power of attorney. And, you know, that was a big concern of the judge. So, you know, even though it could have been less restrictive with Paul, he didn't trust Paul. And so I think that's what the judge found in that regard. And then the third prong, again, the less restrictive means, again, we're going back to Paul. He had, unilaterally.
I do, actually, can I ask one other question about the wasted and dissipated assets? I guess I'm curious on your position on, I think a lot of elderly and non-elderly people have been scammed by, you know, telephone scams. And I think there's, you know, what, you know, part of it is that the scammers are smart and creative. And so how do we sort of balance, you know, how do we balance the fact that, you know, scamming has become a really common practice in evaluating these factors?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. I think you're right. And, you know, I think in a normal functioning family, you know, these protections would be in place to, you know, prevent the scams. But again, you know, the person put in place to protect the scam or the proposed person to be put in place to protect from scamming, you know, there's evidence that he was doing some scamming on his own. He had increased, you know, his pay unilaterally. He had, you know, the judge talked about this $30,000 gift that he was going to make to himself under the power of attorney. So, you know, I understand your question. And in a normal situation, I think that's correct. But here we've got, you know, a very highly dysfunctional family among the siblings. And as you asked, you know, the appellant's counsel, you know, the family dysfunction and the disputes within the family, you know, certainly support, there's case law that you pointed out that support, you know, the implementation of a neutral guardian here. And it certainly makes sense that in this case that the, you know, my clients could have themselves petitioned for guardianship. And Steve had been, you know, he's the one that lived nearby and he's the one that had, you know, primary control over the finances prior to that, but they recognize that this is, you know, a situation where it's best for a neutral person to step in and take place. So
Mr. Johnson,
I think the judge recognized that as well.
Mr. Johnson, may I ask, he referenced the $30,000 gift. I think the argument is it's that the district court clearly erred in concluding and finding that he planned to or considered giving himself a $30,000 gift when in fact what it was is characterizing the pay that he received to care for. What is your, and I think that, as I recall, I mean, the family agreed that he should be paid for taking care of the parents at $750 a week, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And then when mom moved in with him, I guess maybe your clients no longer, or didn't think he should get more than that. Is that what they testified to? Or and also about this gift. I mean, it seems like it, I mean, is there a basis to determine that he intended to take up $30,000 as a gift apart from his pay?
Yeah, testimony at the evidentiary hearing, Your Honor, was from Alan, who's the fourth sibling. I wasn't representing him, but he was he testified at trial, and he said that, you know, he testified that Paul had told him that he was going to give himself a $30,000 gift. And I think that's the bit of evidence that the judge latched on to on that. The, you know, the family had agreed to, you know, they certainly recognized that Paul, you know, is entitled to some payment for services. And they had agreed on, I think it was $750 or something like that a week. And the fact that he had, you know, just gone ahead and raised that to $1,250 without the consent of anybody else in the family was concerning to the judge as well.
Did he need anybody's consent?
Well, I think under the circumstances, you know, with, you know, Carolyn
and his mother's presence.
Yeah. No, I don't imagine he probably did, but under the circumstances, this was a family dispute. My clients had, you know, came in with the impression that, you know, they were taking advantage of the mother who was unable medically to take care of these issues themselves. And again, to change the power of attorney, to kick Steve off of his power of attorney, he got locked out of all the accounts that he'd been managing for a long time. And then, you know, evidence of the $30,000 gift to himself and the increase, you know, all of this just kind of smelled a little bit. So, maybe technically not, but under the circumstances, again, with the court's finding that Carolyn was not able to make these decisions on her own, you know, I think he does need consent from the rest of the family, and then ultimately from the guardian or the conservator in this case.
Counsel, is it your sense that on the petition for guardianship, that the court may have been driven by not wanting to impose a full guardianship on the mother and looked at a conservatorship? But it seems like, at least as I understand the modern practice, is to look more specifically at the powers that can be given a guardian and perhaps limit which of those powers a guardian will have. But it seems not to help your position that the guardianship wasn't issued at some point and at some level.
Well, I think the court, you know, probably rightfully distinguished between the guardianship and the conservatorship. And you know, my clients, everybody recognized that Carolyn prefers to live with Paul. I mean, that was something that was considered by the court and something that was important to everybody. So, you know, by finding that she wanted to live with Paul, and the, you know, the elements required for a guardianship finding are different than the conservatorship finding. And while, you know, with that protection in place and with my clients basically saying that they agreed that she should continue to live with Paul because that's where she's the most comfortable, you know, I think that speaks to the, you know, the reason that the court did not appoint a guardianship. But the, you know, looking again specifically at the conservatorship elements and the, you know, the mismanagement and most of this family, you know, dysfunction was financial. And, you know, I think that's what the judge focused on and you know, ultimately found evidence, you know, the evidence that was presented is good evidence. It was, it met the statutory requirements and he made his conclusions of law off of that. So I think it's a very good order. And I've got a minute left, but I think I've stated my argument unless anybody else has any questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Carlson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to pack this all in. So, Your Honor, the case that the 2007 Guardian Wells case and the In re conservatorship of Edwards from 1986, they rely on the In re Strom, that's 286 Northwest 245. That was the Minnesota Supreme Court case that we were talking about. I think when the Supreme Court had made that decision, you know, decades ago, it made sense under the 1935 statute. And it continued on because the legislature never amended or modified the guardianship statute, taking away that broad discretion from district courts when choosing who to appoint. I think now, considering, you know, the policy judgments and seeing how conservatorships and guardianships went along, I think the legislature was in the best position to decide, you know what, I think we need to start looking at a priority list. And that's why the statute clearly says that the word shall consider per this list. And the exception just says that when the court acts, which is an interesting term, instead of the court finds that it's in Carolyn's best interest or someone's best interest, the court has to act in the person's best interest to disregard the priority list. Now, I think that exception should be small. We wouldn't want to broaden it because in every case you could say, well, you know, I think a professional would be better here. I think there should be a specific reason. And here, if, for example, it was the findings weren't clearly erroneous, but there were concerns that Paul had stolen or Stephen or Julia testified that he had previously stolen, then maybe the court should act in Carolyn's best interest. Because Stephen and Julie didn't petition the court to become the guardian conservator, it was only Paul. But here, there's nothing in the record that would allow, in my client's opinion, for the court to just disregard the priority list, full stop. Mr. Johnson said time and again that this is a family dispute, and that's absolutely correct. This is just a family dispute. But instead of recognizing that their mother had some autonomy over her decisions when her husband passed away, Stephen and Julie, who have had that rocky relationship with their mother, and you know, even prior to her husband's death, Carolyn complained of Stephen's involvement in her affairs. They decided to file this petition for guardianship conservatorship without even talking to their mom. And they didn't talk to their mom for almost 7 months until the trial was over. Stephen testified that he didn't want to reach out to his mother until the court trial was done. And he was kind of a little bit upset that it was taking so long. This isn't a case where two sons and daughter, or a son and daughter, are just concerned that their mother's bills aren't getting paid and that she's not able to take care of herself. I would also say that the visitor report was not neutral. It was very clear the visitor did not recommend a guardianship or conservatorship and clearly stated that Carolyn had exhibited a good understanding of the information provided and was concerned about Stephen taking that control over again. Carolyn should be able to have the autonomy to make her own financial decisions without her son. There's no rights under Minnesota law for a son or daughter to go, I don't like the way you're going to spend your estate, so I'm going to go get a conservatorship and with a conservator that I handpick. Paul was not doing any scamming. Mr. Johnson brought that up. Giving himself a raise after talking to an attorney, someone that's represented by counsel, is the appropriate thing to do. Now, if Paul talked to just his mother and his counsel was not involved, I think that would have been inappropriate. But here it's clear that Paul worked with Carolyn's counsel in determining whether to get that raise or whether a raise was appropriate because of the now increased continuum of care. And even Stephen testified, I don't have the transcript, but Stephen did testify that that would be reasonable under the circumstances. That makes sense that you'd want to raise if you're going to work more hours. And considering how much it costs, and I've been working in guardianship conservatorship, $6,000 to $10,000 to put someone in a living facility, paying Paul $1,200 a week for full-time care was not unreasonable. It would be, I could imagine the district court being very concerned if Paul took a $10,000 a month or $20,000 a month salary. But considering the amount of care and the fact that Carolyn wants that care, and my client wants her son to be able to take care of her so she doesn't go to a nursing home, her son is forgoing 401ks, Social Security, all of that to take care of his mother. So it's not one of those things where Paul's over here scamming anything. Carolyn wants to live with Paul. She has always gotten along with her son. When her husband passed away, which was very tough on her, she decided to go live with her son, which is actually a good decision. Sometimes, and I've encountered where some people don't want to leave their home. They want to live all by themselves. And maybe that wouldn't be appropriate here, but Carolyn made the right decision with advice of counsel. And lastly, I just don't think the family feud thing is relevant to this. It shouldn't be relevant to this court's analysis because the district court didn't address it. Respondents below brought this argument in their brief to the trial court after the trial, arguing about the family feud. The district court made no findings on it. He just had concerns about Paul. And those findings were clearly erroneous. So we would ask the court either reverse the appointment of a conservator or reverse and remand with the appointment of Carolyn's choice, her son, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in this matter within the time prescribed by statute.